Welcome to the Bioethics Babe podcast, where we examine the tough questions in human flourishing in light of science, faith, and culture. I'm your host, Arina Grosso Agnew. Now let's dive in. In this deeply moving episode, Bishop James Conley of the Diocese of Lincoln shares his remarkable journey of faith, conversion, and healing. From his path to the Catholic Church and his vocation to the priesthood, to his honest reflections on struggling with depression and finding hope in Christ, Bishop Conley offers a profound Catholic perspective on mental health, reminding listeners that holiness and healing can be achieved even amidst mental struggles. He opens up about what led him to write his pastoral letter, A Future with Hope, how faith and therapy can work together, and why surrender and community are essential to the healing process. With his characteristic wisdom, humility, and warmth, Bishop Conley reminds us that even in darkness, God is still there. Ultimately, he offers a message of hope, encouraging those in darkness to reach out and seek support. Bishop Conley brings the same depth of faith and experience to his wider service in the church, including his roles as Episcopal advisor to both the Catholic Medical Association and the Catholic Healthcare Leadership Alliance. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Today, I'm honored to welcome Bishop James Conley, the ninth bishop of the Diocese of Lincoln, Nebraska, to the Bioethics Babe podcast. Born in Kansas City and raised in Overland Park, Kansas, Bishop Conley converted to Catholicism while studying English literature at the University of Kansas. After graduation, he continued the university's Integrated Humanities program, which helped deepen and shape his Catholic faith. After discerning a call to the priesthood, Bishop Conley entered Mount St. Mary's Seminary in Emmitsburg, Maryland, and was ordained a priest for the Diocese of Wichita in 1985. He later pursued advanced studies in Rome, earning a licentiate in sacred theology from the Accademia Alfonsiana, part of the Pontifical Lateran University. Over the years, he served as a parish priest, director of the Diocesan Respect Life Office, chaplain at Wichita State University, and as an official in the Vatican's Congregation for Bishops. In 2008, Pope Benedict XVI appointed him Auxiliary Bishop of Denver, and in 2012, Bishop of Lincoln, where he continues to serve today. Fun fact, we had the privilege of having Bishop Conley concelebrate our wedding and receive our vows. We were joined by 11 concelebrants, including Archbishop Joseph Naumann, Bishop Conley, of course, and 9 of our priest friends. Bishop Conley is truly salt of the earth, kind, funny, humble, a truth teller, and a joyful apostle for Christ. My family and I are blessed to call him a friend, and today he'll bless all of us with this important conversation on his faith and health journey and the Catholic view of mental health. Your Excellency, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Arena.
So before we dive into the topic of mental health, can you share with our listeners your conversion story to the Catholic faith?
I'd be happy to. I'll do the short version because I could talk forever on that. But as you said in the bio, it was really during my university years that I discovered the Catholic Church, primarily through literature and music and poetry and all part of this integrated humanities program, you know, through a series of a lot of reading and a lot of study. It was before they had the OCIA programs in the parishes. So I go way back. And it was just a matter of kind of reading my way into the Catholic Church, like so many that I was with at the university. But then again, as I look back on it, it was the friendships that were made during those college years and seeing the example of faith lived out in other Catholics that led me to the Catholic Church. And then finally, I knew that I had to make a decision about where I wanted to be as a Christian, because I think I always was a Christian. I might have been an agnostic for a number of years, but I never denied God. I don't think I was ever an atheist. Time to really say, okay, what do I really believe in? It was the Catholic Church that I found a real home in, and sort of, and Newman, as I mentioned, and I took his motto as my Episcopal motto. So John Henry Cardinal Newman, now Doctor of the Church, had a big influence on me. His life, who also was a convert to the Catholic faith, and this is example and how he kind of came to his faith in a university setting. So Newman had a tremendous impact on my decision to become a Catholic. And as he said, so beautifully. To be deep into history is to cease to be Protestant. And so that was really what, when I started to look at the Catholic Church in history and see and trace it all the way back to Jesus, it was really the historical claim of being the one church that could trace itself all the way back to the apostolic times and to Jesus himself that convinced me that this is the church I needed to be in. And so I became a Catholic at that point.
That's beautiful. Well, we're both in the convert club, and I think converts make good Catholics.
I think maybe it's because there's a certain excitement about the faith because it came new to us, not being born into a Catholic family. You know, cradle Catholics, I think, do have an advantage over us in that they've had all those years of grace when we were out in the wilderness, sort of trying to find our way. And so sometimes I see Catholics that have the faith so much a part of them where I feel like I'll always be a convert. I'll always be sort of new to this. I don't know about you.
Absolutely. And there's always more to learn about the faith and, of course, the treasure of the church fathers and the whole history of the church. So it's a blessing to be part of the Catholic faith. I'm right there with you.
That's right.
So you mentioned John Henry Cardinal Newman and the motto that you took, which is cor ad cor locutor, which means heart speaks to heart. Why was that so impactful on you?
Well, I think really it spoke to me because it really was the way Newman lived his life. And his life was built upon friendships that he made throughout his life. And when I finally had to decide a motto, and they don't teach you that in the seminary, that if you ever become a bishop, you've got to choose a motto. And I didn't really know about that. And so when I had to do that, I was looking through the scriptures, of course, first. And then one of my friends actually told me, he says, why don't you just take Newman's motto? You know, he had such an impact on your life. I said, yeah, that makes sense. And so I did. But then I got a little bit, I was concerned because I was wondering if you could steal somebody else's motto. Once they have a motto, it's sort of now nobody else can use it. And then I called my good friend, Father Ian Carr, God rest his soul. He died a few years ago, but he was a biographer of Newman, probably wrote the definitive biography of Newman. And I knew he would know the answer to this question. So I called him and asked him is it possible, you know, to take Newman's motto? Can you do that? And he said, well, actually, yes, you can, because Newman stole it himself. It was from St. Francis de Sales in a letter that St. Francis de Sales wrote to one of his spiritual directees. And she said, okay, you can go ahead and use it. It's free. It's free game. So go ahead. So that's how I ended up choosing Newman's motto, heart speaks to heart. And it's, you know, it's one of those beautiful sayings that you can take two ways. It's the heart of Jesus speaking to our hearts, but then it's also our human hearts speaking to like your human heart or whoever we meet. So there's the friendship, sort of the horizontal understanding of it. Then also there's the vertical that Jesus's sacred heart speaks to our heart.
I think that's beautiful and it's very apt because you obviously have a very close relationship with Jesus and also you speak with the laity and others around you from the heart, and people can tell that, the warmth and the fact that you can really communicate to them in a way that they can receive it. I think it's perfect for you.
Thank you. I hope so.
Can you please tell us a little bit about what led you to become a priest?
That's kind of easy because when I graduated from university and I was a new Catholic and I wasn't sure what God was calling me to, and I had this degree in English literature. I wasn't so keen on teaching, maybe go to graduate school, but that never really crossed my mind. And then I did a lot of traveling at that time after college and ended up at a French Benedictine monastery called Foncambeau in France, where a lot of my friends had ended up going because we heard about this place in France that still preserved the Gregorian chant in its fullness and beauty. It had a traditional Latin liturgy, and it was like stepping back into the Middle Ages because they had restored an 11th century monastery, part of the Congregation of Salem, which was the Benedictine Abbey in the 19th century that really restored Gregorian chant under Abbot Dom Guéranger. And so I ended up spending like 8 months there. And that's when I first started thinking, you know, gosh, maybe God is calling me to be a monk. I know I wrote a letter home to my mom and it freaked her out because then she knew if I became a monk that, you know, somehow, you know, I would end up in this monastery and she'd never see me again. My mom and dad never see me again. And so after a while, I thought, well, no, I don't think I'm being called a monk. To be a monk. I think I'm being called back to my home country. So I went back and I thought I was called to be a husband and a father. I thought I had the vocation to marriage. And so a lot of my friends were getting married. I was in my mid-20s and I was actually dating a girl. I started dating a girl, my first Catholic girlfriend. And I thought, well, this is what I'm supposed to do, get married, have 10 kids, you know, raise a nice Catholic family. She was Catholic. Then something happened and it was exactly on October 4th, 1979, the feast of St. Francis of Assisi, that the new pope in Rome came to the United States for the first time. John Paul II came to Boston, New York, Philadelphia, Washington, Chicago, and Des Moines, Iowa. And of course, Des Moines, Iowa was the closest to Kansas. And a bunch of us all piled into vans and we drove up to Des Moines. And it was a beautiful setting because it was an outdoor mass on the Feast of St. Francis. It was during harvest season. There were big hay bales piled up behind the altar. And it was rainy all morning long. And all of a sudden, the clouds parted. And out of the sky descended this helicopter. And there was this white figure in the helicopter that everybody was looking up at. And he was waving. And he landed right next to the altar. And he got out. And 300,000 people were there in this beautiful rural setting. And, you know, he vested and ascended to the stage and had this beautiful mass. And everybody was just taken by him. Like, you know, he happened wherever he went, especially those first few years. It was before he was shot. So he was still very vigorous and, you know, very manly and had a commanding presence about him. And at the end of the mass, I remember there were a few of us that there were some people in wheelchairs that were seated around us. And somebody said that, you know, that there's a special place for these people who are disabled. If somebody, some of you young fellows want to wheelchair, pull these wheelchairs up, these people will get a good place. And so I knew that if I did that, I had to stay up there with them because somebody had to bring them back. And so this was sort of my ticket to the front row. So not too altruistic in my motives, but anyway. A couple of us wheeled some people up there and we were there right in front during the whole mass. And at the end of the mass, as he was wont to do, he came down and he blessed all the people. At that point, he was maybe 20, 30 feet in front of me. And before he came down, he said, "Now, young men, consider the priesthood, follow Jesus, follow me." And those were really the last words when he came down. And I was just struck by those words. And I'd never really thought that maybe God was calling me to be a parish priest. I thought about being a monk, but I didn't think God would be calling me to be a parish priest. And so he walked right in front, blessed these people. And I, to this day, I can still see his blue eyes, his cobalt blue eyes, and looking at me. And I think he winked at me, but I'm not sure. Maybe that's just in my imagination. And really, it was from that moment at that mass that I received the call to the priesthood. And I went back, and at the time I was living out in the country with some friends of mine who had just gotten married, two couples got married, and I was sort of the fifth wheel, kind of waiting to get married. And we were harvesting that fall, and I just kept thinking, the priesthood, the priesthood, the priesthood. Finally, I decided I needed to talk to somebody, so I talked to my girlfriend, and she actually made the appointment to visit her pastor, who she was very, her family was very close to her pastor, Monsignor Walsh, God rest him. And so she actually set the appointment up and I went down to Wichita. That's how I ended up in Wichita because she was living in Wichita and she was a school teacher. I met with Monsignor Walsh and he said, well, he says, maybe you should talk to the bishop. And so he made an appointment with the bishop and I talked to the bishop. And by January, I was off to the seminary. I mean, it happened that quickly. Now, there's a much longer process these days. And I think that's good. It was just a matter of phone call. Do you have a bed for this guy? And that was it, you know. So now they do a much more lengthy process, which is good. But for me, it was just, it happened boom, boom, boom. And in January of, I guess that was 1980, just 4 months after the Pope came, I was in the seminary and just never looked back.
Wow, that's beautiful. And we were both touched by Pope John Paul II. My family, once we converted, he came to Giants Stadium. I didn't have front row seats or close up to him, but he really touched our hearts. That was very soon after our conversion as a family. And so we were very deeply touched by St. John Paul II's life as well and the holiness that he exuded. And kudos to your ex-girlfriend for being so gracious in allowing you to pursue your vocation and helping you.
She was very selfless. Here's another little side note, which I think is neat. She didn't want to come between God and a vocation to the priesthood. She loved the church so much. And so she very selflessly just sort of bowed out. And so fast forward, I'm in the seminary for 5.5 years, ordained a priest. I'm assigned my first assignment to St. Patrick's Parish in Wichita. And lo and behold, my girlfriend, Kathy, who had met a fellow during the time I was in the seminary and just got married, moved into that parish and had her first child. And I baptized her first child. So
that
was
beautiful.
A nice little sort of full circle.
Exactly. Wow. Thank you for sharing that. Actually, I wanted to ask you about another very impactful experience in your life, which was that you had the privilege of baptizing both your mother and father and receiving them into the Catholic Church in 1991. So can you tell us a little bit more about that experience for you?
Sure. I mean, next to my ordination day, that was probably the happiest day of my life. You know, when you're ordained a priest, they tell you to put some special intentions on your heart as you lay prostrate there, giving your life to God in the church. And so one of the petitions I had was for the conversion of my parents. They were good Christian people. We didn't go to church much growing up. My father's side of the family was Baptist. My mother's side was Presbyterian. But there really was no formal religious training in our home. Me and my sister just kind of grew up in that house and that family. So when I converted during my college years, my parents kind of were influenced by that program I was in at the university, and then they met my friends, and a lot of my friends were Catholic. And then, of course, when I became a seminarian, they met a lot of other friends who were also seminarians. And so they kind of had this slow introduction to the Catholic faith. I think it was after my first assignment, I was assigned to St. Patrick's, the same parish I mentioned earlier, and my pastor, who was an Irish priest, born and raised, Father Donald O'Hare, with a heavy Cork accent, Irish Cork accent, and my dad fell in love with him. And they would come down and visit me, and of course, this newly ordained priest, the parishioners, you know, just sort of fawned over this baby priest, and my mom couldn't believe how the ladies in the parish treated her son, you know. And so that was a great introduction to the Catholic faith for them. And then when I went off for graduate school after being ordained 4.5 years, while I was in Rome studying, unbeknownst to me, my parents started looking into the Catholic Church. And I kind of got a hint of that because I remember when my mom, when I was in France and I wrote her that letter about becoming a monk, and, you know, she thought I'd lost my mind. But I knew that she was thinking about it. So there was a priest in Overland Park where my parents lived who was a good friend of mine, Father Don Cullen. And this was before the OCIA and, you know, kind of the longer process. And I knew my parents were thinking about the Catholic Church. And so I when I was back for vacation, I asked him, I said, why don't you give my parents a call sometime and just invite them over, introduce yourself. And I think they would like to come over because I think they're kind of interested in the Catholic Church. So he did that, and sure enough, they came over for dinner. He liked to cook, and my dad hit it off with him. And then I got this letter right before I came home from Rome that my mom and dad, my mother wrote the letter, and she said, your father and I have decided we want to become Catholic, and we'd like for you to receive us into the Catholic Church. Well, they found out, too, that they'd never been baptized.
Wow.
And so when I came home, that would have been August 2nd of 1991, in my former parish where Father O'Hare was the pastor and the bishop came and a lot of my priest friends came. And so I baptized, confirmed, and gave them their first Holy Communion all in one day. Like I said, that was a very happy day. Yeah, a real grace and an answer to prayers.
Yes, yes. If anyone wonders if answers to prayers are real, they are, right?
Yes.
God hears our prayers, especially the ones to grow in holiness,
right? That's right. That's right. When you least expect it.
Now, I think we should just dive into the mental health topic, which is the bulk of what this episode is about. And it just so happens to be that on October 10th is World Mental Health Day. So this topic is very apropos. And I pulled up some stats on mental health. So the World Health Organization, according to them, more than 1 billion people are living with mental health conditions globally. That's one in every 8 people are living with a mental health disorder. And so this topic is so important because it affects may affect us personally, or it may affect friends and family of ours. And so we are surrounded by it. And I think that because there's so much stigma surrounds the mental health issue, I think it's really important to just take that on. And I think that with your witness, you did so beautifully. Bishop Conley wrote a pastoral letter in May 2024 called A Future with Hope. And in that pastoral letter, you shared your own struggles with mental health. What motivated you to write that letter publicly at that point in your ministry?
Well, as I mentioned in my family upbringing, I really did come from a good family. My parents were married for 59 years until my father died. It was a very good marriage, and they loved us as children, my sister and I. So I didn't have any history of mental illness or any kind of trauma, childhood trauma. So oftentimes, I think, as I have become more aware of mental health struggles and various kind of situations, that a lot of mental health struggle is a result of some sort of childhood trauma or some sort of childhood event, or, you know, a dysfunctional family. Let's say there's divorce. So I didn't have any of that. So I wasn't very likely to, you know, suffer from mental health struggles. So kind of as a preface to my comments, I just wanted to say that because I think it's important, because it doesn't have to be a result of you know, any kind of trauma in your childhood. Mental health struggles can happen to anyone, no matter how stable your life has been, how wonderful of a family you came from, or even how strong of a faith background you have. It's part of being human. I mean, we are fallen human beings, and that means that we have a human nature, and sometimes that bodiliness of our being has struggles. It's just the way it is. It's like anything else, any other kind of health struggle. So for me, my problems really began in the late teens, 2018, 19, 20, kind of leading up to COVID. I was, you know, all of my life, I've always been very kind of a positive person, and I wasn't given to, you know, depression or anything like that. I've always been pretty happy-go-lucky, you know, and the way I looked at life, it was really through kind of the pressures of being a bishop that my troubles began, and they were a combination of things that sort of, like, I could call it a perfect storm. If you'll recall, those who are Catholics and even non-Catholics will remember that the summer of 2018. Was the Cardinal McCarrick revelations about, you know, the horrible scourge of clergy sexual abuse. It just exploded. There was the first sort of wave in 2002, and then there was a second wave in 2018. And so as a bishop, this terrible evil really goes to the heart of our faith, and bishops especially, because that second wave in 2018, there was a lot that was revealed about the negligence of bishops, who mishandled allegations of clergy sexual abuse, and that implicates all bishops. Even though, let's say, you didn't have any direct part to play in a particular story, still though you're affected by it, because it was, you know, your predecessor or three bishops before you, or a bishop in a different diocese. It was also the same summer that the Pennsylvania grand jury report was released, and all these horrible stories, you know, terrible crimes and sins against young people And it was just a real painful time to be a Catholic, really, quite honestly, and especially to be a bishop. You know, I really felt I had a heart for those victims of clergy sexual abuse and those who had been carrying this terrible thing for so long. In my own particular diocese, there was a couple of incidents of priests that had to be removed because of misconduct, sexual misconduct. Thanks be to God, and very few with minors, but there were some that were, you know, particularly difficult cases. And I felt like I was acting correctly, and I did what I was supposed to do. And then when in the fall of 2008, there was a Attorney General investigation in all three dioceses in the state of Nebraska. And so we had to turn over all of our personnel files, and we did that. We did that immediately according to the law. And, you know, we have nothing to hide. If there's something in our past personnel files that need to be looked at, well, let's in the spirit of transparency, let's let it all open up the wound, so to speak. And so we did that. And that it, like a lot of investigations, they take a long time. And I think that started to worry me. Like, what if there is something there? And what if I made a decision that was not the best decision? And all of these concerns began to kind of mount up in my life. At the same time, my sister was diagnosed with breast cancer. I had a priest, fairly young priest, who was struggling with alcohol. We tried to get him help. And he ended up dying suddenly because of alcoholism. I had to close two struggling schools, which is always very dramatic and traumatic. These schools just were not sustainable anymore. They were some of our oldest schools in some of our poorest neighborhoods. And so that was really difficult. So all these things started to kind of press down upon me. And in that fall of 2018, the first kind of indication that something wasn't right was the fact that I wasn't sleeping, and I didn't realize that I wasn't sleeping. And then about, I think maybe October of that fall, I woke up one morning and I had this ringing in my ears, which is tinnitus. And it's this, and it's brought on also by stress. So I had the ringing in my ears, I wasn't sleeping, and I was trying to figure out, navigate all of these challenges. We formed our own task force to look at our files, to make sure that everything was documented and everything, we were being very transparent for all of that we had in our files. And then week after week, you know, I'd lay in bed at night and just sort of run through all these cases in my mind. And I made the big mistake, and looking back on it, you know, hindsight's 20/20. I was thinking wrongly that I had to solve all these problems. That I'm the bishop, that it's up to me to fix everything that's broken and to heal everyone that's hurting and to correct all the wrongs that were happening, which is very, very much prideful, you know, to think that, you know, I can do that. First of all, no one person can do that. And to think that you, even as a bishop, that you're the one responsible for all of this is really not good thinking. But that's the way it was. And I thought that I'd cement. So I just laid awake at night and thought through all these things. And, you know, time went on into the winter of 2019, and things weren't getting better. And finally, in March of that year, 2019, I needed to get some help. And that's when I decided that I should go to the Mayo Clinic. I have a couple of friends that are physicians at the Mayo Clinic, and I'm the Catholic Episcopal advisor to the Catholic Medical Association. So I had met a lot of physicians. And so I went up to Mayo and had a full physical just to see, why am I not sleeping? And how can I, I was losing weight, and, you know, and everything was just sort of spiraling out of control. And so I went up there in March of 2019, and that's where I was diagnosed, because I went through a whole battery of tests, top to bottom, and I was diagnosed with anxiety and major depressive disorder. So I said, okay, and the tinnitus, they were trying to see what caused the tinnitus, and so at least I know something's wrong. And so I began counseling, and I went on medication. And things got better for a while. And through that summer of 2019, but then I only kind of got to a certain point. I was still not really sleeping, and things were still unresolved with regard to all of the report. The investigation hadn't concluded, so there was a lot of fear about what's going to happen. And in the fall of 2019, it was really my sister that was home visiting my family, and she said, "You know, you look terrible. So you need to take some time off." And I said, "Well, I don't think I can take time off. I mean, bishops can't, you know, they can't, they have to stay on the job." And she goes, "But yeah, but this is, you're not doing well. And if you keep doing this, something's going to happen. You're going to have a breakdown." And so I thought about that because she knows me very well. And then a couple of my friends, close friends, also indicated to me that I was not doing well, and I needed to step down and do something, or else things were really going to, you know, I was really going to crash. So I talked to one of my best friends, Archbishop Coakley, the Archbishop of Oklahoma City, and a few other bishop friends, that they said, "Well, why don't you go to the nuncio and ask them if you could take some time off and attend to your, you know, mental health and your physical health and everything else?" And Bishop Jim Wall, who's the Bishop of Gallup, New Mexico, said, "Why don't you go to Phoenix for the winter, you know, get a lot of sunshine?" And Bishop Olmsted, who was in Phoenix, was my former bishop in Wichita and a priest of Lincoln. I called him up and said, "You know, if I get some time off, could I come down?" And he said, "Sure, come on down. We've got a nice little retirement retreat center that you can stay. We have a number of retired priests that are there. You can spend the winter down, or however long you need to take." So that's where I kind of decided I needed to do that. So then I went to the Apostolic Nuncio at our meeting in Baltimore in fall, November of 2019. And Cardinal Pierre, who still is our nuncio, I approached him with Archbishop Coakley and Bishop Wall and Archbishop Lucas, who was my metropolitan, and Bishop Olmsted, and just presented this: "Can I take some time off?" And immediately he said, "Of course." He said, "Yeah, you do look awful. You need to take some time off. You need to get some rest, and you need to get healthy." And so that was a relief. And when I asked him, I said, "Well, what should I tell the people? What should I say?" And this was a stroke of grace on his part. He said, "Well, just tell them the truth. Just be honest. Say that you've been diagnosed with anxiety and depression. You're not sleeping. You've got this ringing in your ears, and you just really have to step aside and take care of your health and well-being." And so I did that, you know, and I thought, you know, that I couldn't say that. I had to say, you know, he's taking a leave for personal reasons or whatever, you know, and which that would have been terrible, because then people would think all kinds of things. So the easiest thing, and a lot of people say that was very courageous, but the easiest thing for me was just to be honest and to tell my story. And I did that, and people understood, you know, and I got so many prayers. And I left the diocese in December of 2019, December 13th, the Feast of St. Lucy, and went down to Phoenix. And I thought I'd only be down there for a couple of months, but I ended up being away for 11 months before I came back. And like I like to say, you know, in December of 2019, I took a leave of absence from my diocese for health reasons. And then in March of 2020, the whole world took a leave of absence.
Right.
When COVID hit. And so then when the pandemic hit, and I was doing pretty well up to that point, but that added another layer of isolation and loneliness. Mm-hmm. Here I was in a foreign city, and the whole world now was being quarantined and isolated, and you couldn't talk to people. You had to wear masks. And that didn't help my situation. But I did have a good spiritual director that I could go see on a regular basis, a good psychotherapist who was Catholic and who was recommended by Bishop Olmsted, and a good doctor who I could see. And then probably the thing that was most important, that there was a family that I had as students when I was chaplain, when I lived in Rome, working for the Vatican at the University of Dallas. I was chaplain for the University of Dallas, and it was a young couple. And there were several other young couples who I had as students and now married and having their children. Since we were all isolated, I get to spend a lot of time at their home, and they were missing having Mass. So I asked permission to say Mass in their homes. It was a win-win. They got Mass when their churches were shut down, and I was able to say Mass for a flock, even though it was a little one family flock. It was good just to be around a family and normal people. And they just welcomed me with open arms. And, you know, we became so close. We were already close, but we became so close during those months. And I think more, probably more than anything, that was so therapeutic, just to be not alone, but with a family. And so a combination of all those things helped me to gain my mental health again. And then in the fall of 2020, you know, the second wave of the pandemic hit again. But I was ready to go back. My psychotherapist suggested that I would shadow a bishop for a couple of months before I go back. And so I did. I went to Oklahoma City with Archbishop Coakley and stayed with him for about 5 weeks. And then I was with Archbishop Nauman, our mutual friend, for about 6 weeks in Kansas City. And confirmations were starting back up again. So I helped him with confirmations. And then in November 13th, exactly 11 months later of 2020, I received permission from Pope Francis to come back to my diocese. And so that was my, you know, time away. And coming back, those first years were rough. I think 2021 was rough. My mother died suddenly of COVID a month after I came back. And that was another blow. And but, you know, I was able to be with her. So that was a grace. I went through 2021 and then 2022. And then slowly but surely, I regained my health. And then to kind of complete this segment, in 2024, I was talking to a good friend of mine, and he suggested that, you know, maybe I should write up my story, and maybe others could be helped by it. And it was really because of my work on a U.S. Bishop's committee, a committee for laity, marriage, family life, and youth that the Bishop Barron chairs. I'm still on that committee with him. We were placing a particular emphasis on mental health. So Mental Health Awareness Month is in May. And so I thought, well, maybe I'll try to tell my story and publish it in May of 2024. And so I did. I got it done and published it. And then that was also a great kind of therapeutic moment of being able to tell my story to a larger audience. And I've been asked to speak at different places, give talks in different settings about mental health and how can we deal with it, which seems to be an epidemic, you know, everywhere. Families in the priesthood and in religious life. And so that's kind of full circle how I ended up writing the pastoral letter.
Thank you so much for sharing that. And it does take a lot of courage to share that with the world, essentially. But I think that in your witness, you have helped and you are helping people as they are dealing with their own mental health or with friends and family who are also dealing with that. You mentioned that you had some physical symptoms. You had the insomnia, the tinnitus, anxiety, depression. But then there was also the emotional aspect, which was the loss of joy or fears, all the things that you were talking about as the diocesan investigations were happening. Which of those symptoms, whether it was the physical or the emotional ones, the psychological, what would you say was the hardest to bear, and how did it affect your daily life and ministry?
Yeah, that's a very good question, because once I went away and I was able to sort of step back and think about my life and where I was at that moment in my life, I realized that the anxiety, and this happens a lot in when people suffer from anxiety, is that, you know, the anxious feelings very quickly go to fear. You know, like, what are people going to think of me? How am I going to continue on in this state of mind? That for me, at least, from those fears and kind of intrepidation, you hit this kind of wall where you just say, I can't do this anymore, you know, and that's where the joy disappears. It's just like my whole life is basically over. You know, everything I've done up to now, I'm not ever going to get any better. And you know, then the depression comes in and, you know, you don't see you have a future. And then the worst thing, Arena, is this loss of joy. It's like, I don't care anymore. I can see now, I didn't have really strong suicidal ideation, but I could see it. I could see it. Like I even thought, well, maybe, I'll just accidentally step out in the street and I'll get hit by a car, you know, and that'll just end it all right there. I mean, and I can see where people get these ideas that, you know, they don't want to be here anymore. And, you know, facing, you know, the world and the demands of the world, you know, you just can't go on. And so that really was the worst of it all, was just to say like, it was so foreign to me because I, like I said, I always was a very optimistic person, filled with joy, kind of happy-go-lucky, never really had dark thoughts, you know, ever. And yet now I was starting to have dark thoughts and starting to think, gosh, maybe this is it. And then, you know, and this probably begs the question, but then what about your spiritual life? You can't pray yourself out of a situation like this as much as you would like to or think that you could, because as St. Thomas Aquinas tells us, that grace builds on nature. But if your health, your physiology is suffering, then grace can only do so much. Now, I believe in the power of miracles and healing. There is this thin partition between your psychological health and your spiritual health. And they do kind of cross over. And it's very mysterious how they sort of go back and forth. I didn't stop praying because I knew I couldn't. I knew if I gave up praying, then I was really lost, you know, because that was like the only thread that I was holding on to. And so, as I talk about in my pastoral letter, there were the three anchors for me. There was the Liturgy of the Hours, the Breviary, which are filled with the Psalms. And the Psalms were really a great consolation to me because in the Psalms, there's every kind of human emotion and every kind of human feeling, highs and lows, the depths to the heights. And so going through those Psalms every day, you know, and kind of relating to the psalmist, David, who's expressing his heart. And then there was the Mass, and I remember sometimes just sort of dragging myself to the altar to be able just to celebrate Mass to get through it. And I was saying Mass privately, which is kind of listening to yourself say the words and there's no congregation. That's why saying Mass for that family was so important. And then also I started saying Mass for a group of sisters, all my Mercy sisters. And then the Rosary. And I knew that the rosary is beautiful in so many ways because you don't really have to think, you know, really. I mean, you can just hold on to those beads and you go through those beads and it keeps you moving forward, you know, one bead after another, after another, after another. And then, yeah, you're trying to meditate on those mysteries, but it was like a chain that I was holding on to, keeping me connected. And I guess the other thing too was St. Joseph. St. Joseph there was a statue of St. Joseph right outside this little casita where I was staying at the base of Camelback Mountain in Phoenix. And I would just see St. Joseph every day. And that was a time when that book by Father Calloway came out and St. Joseph was all the rage. Everybody was consecrating themselves to St. Joseph. And so I did. And being born on March 19th, you know, I should be Joseph. I should be my hero. And he was. But I never really had that much of a devotion to him. So I went through that whole consecration to St. Joseph. And so those spiritual things were keeping me connected, but they weren't offering much consolation at all. And the joy, I mean, the joy, there would be glimpses of joy, but then back to desolation. Glimpses of joy, then back to desolation. But I knew I couldn't give up on these things. And I kept holding on to them. And then as time went on, you know, the moments of desolation became shorter, and then the joy slowly but surely came back. But it was this struggle between prayer and desolation that I was in for a very long time.
There are a lot of questions that I want to ask you. One of them, so you're talking about desolation, and it sounds like you experienced a dark night of the soul. In your letter, you said that it reminds you of the moon in the desert sky. You said, because the moon waxes and wanes, there are a few days in the lunar cycle where it disappears from view. It is still there, of course, but the naked eye can't see it. It's the same with God. Even when I can't see, hear, or feel him, he is still there. And then you said that recovery did not happen overnight, but gradual coming out of the darkness. What do you say to someone who may not have the faith, either the Christian faith or any faith at all? And, you know, you clung to the Rosary, the Mass, the Psalms, what can someone who doesn't have the faith cling on to? And of course, the sacraments as well. What would you say to somebody who doesn't have any faith?
Well, I think I would say that there, when you were talking, I just had a flashback of, I remember stepping outside of this little casita I was in, and about midnight, the moon would always be in the same place. And I would just stand there and look at the moon, whether it was full or half or even a quarter. And I would just take consolation in knowing that that's there, you know, and that there's an order to these heavenly bodies. Because then there were other times during the lunar month where it was gone, and yet I knew exactly where it was. If I had a powerful telescope, I could probably see it, but I couldn't see it because the Earth was blocking the sun. But I knew it was there, and I knew that it would come back, and the sun would come up in the morning, and that the world would continue on. You know, it almost sounds pagan, but I took a consolation in the order of the cycles of the moon and the stars that were always familiar every night in the clear desert sky, that there was order to the universe and that there was purpose. This wasn't just this random world, that there's no rhyme or reason to it, and we're all just sort of a speck of dust that you know, doesn't have any direction. Purely from a non-spiritual faith dimension, I took consolation in that order, that symmetry of the world. And I suppose for somebody who doesn't have any faith but yet can recognize these physical touch points, like the moon or the stars, it's something that they could look to as something stable that doesn't change. And maybe that would help someone who doesn't have any faith at all. But then I think if you look at it hard enough, then you ask your question like, well, how does all this stuff stay together? How does all this stuff work? Then you say, well, something must be even more powerful than the orbit of the moon, or more powerful than the stars that are hurling through the universe. You know, there's got to be some intelligent design around all this.
You stated it so beautifully. And I do think that obviously, even if you don't have faith, you can see the beauty of what God has created, what we see as what God has created, and the intelligence of it, which is part of the whole reason for the Bioethics Babe podcast, that you can actually see intelligence in the created world, in biology and science, and whether you have faith or not. So I wanted to ask you, okay, so if for someone who may have the faith and clinging to the faith, and you mentioned that times it felt like a chore to go to Holy Mass or the Rosary or the Liturgy of the Hours, but why is it important to stay the course in a spiritual life, even if you're experiencing spiritual dryness? And how important are prayer and the sacraments in the healing process?
Right. I think there's where that virtue of perseverance really comes into play. And, you know, it's more than just kind of white knuckling it. You know, sometimes we do have to do that because it's the only way we're going to get through a particular struggle that we have. Everything's in your head, which is really terrible, because I remember one of my friends, Chris Stefanik, you know, Chris Stefanik does a lot of things. I remember one talk he gave to a bunch of high school kids. He said, you know, the mind is like a deep, dark forest. You never want to go in there alone, you know, and it's true. You know, you don't want to go into your thoughts alone and to get out of your thoughts. And that's where I think getting out and going for a walk, for example, or run if you can, riding a bike, a walk in the woods, that helps you to get out of your head and helps you to go on. You know, if you sit, the worst thing I think is just sitting alone in your room and just being in your own head. That's where I think people really get in trouble, because your whole world shrinks down to something very small. And then you get this idea, well, if I just put myself out of this misery, then nobody will ever know and it'll be over, you know, and that's where the bad thoughts come in. So I guess I'm kind of talking around your question.
Why is it important to stay the course in the spiritual life, even if you're experiencing spiritual dryness, and the importance of prayer and the sacraments in the healing process?
So then you're like, well, what's the alternative? You know, the alternative is to give up. Okay, I'm going to give up. Well, then what are you going to do? You know, I mean, it's, you know, if you look at the alternative and say, well, I can just throw my hands up and not do anything. Well, you're not going to be better off from that. So why not just keep plugging away and persevering? And second part of that is, and when you talk to people, and this is where a therapist is really good. You know, the therapist will tell you, like mine did, he would say, look, you're not the only one that's been in this spot. You know, you think that you're the only one that's ever come to this point in your life. You know, this is actually quite common. And people have gotten through this, and you'll get through this. And, you know, there is light at the end of the tunnel, but you have to walk through it in order to get to the other side. And that's really your best option right now. Is I know you can't understand it. You don't know why this is happening at this time in your life, and you know, whatever. You just have to put one foot. In fact, one of the things he said to me, which I still have it written down, he said, just show up. Just show up. Sometimes life is just showing up. And don't think too much beyond the present moment, but just put yourself, get dressed, you know, wash your face, take a shower, whatever, walk out the door and just show up, because the alternative is not the answer.
Right. And just take that next step, whatever that next step is.
Even
if it's the tiniest little step, just take it. And little by little, you will get to where you want to be, actually. I wanted to go back to what you mentioned about the dark night. It's really a despair, right? Or, there's the feeling of an absence of God, but also I believe that the devil can just tempt us with despair, the hopelessness. What's the point? What's the point of my life? Why does it even matter? No one would miss me. All those types of questions. Could you speak a little bit about the role of the evil one who tempts us and who steals our joy, steals our hope, and puts us in this place of despair, and how people can counter that? Because that is very much a spiritual battle as much as it is a psychological one.
Mm-hmm. No, that's a good point, Arena. And I've spent a lot of time with, my spiritual director when I was in Phoenix, but also our exorcist here in my diocese, who is very experienced in dealing with the evil one. You know, it's funny. He has helped me to recognize when the evil one is putting these thoughts in your mind, and knowing that they're not from God. And when you do realize that, you also know from our faith that he's powerless before Jesus. And so I still have it in my breviary. You know, when I get these thoughts, and I do sometimes, you know, and sometimes, and we can talk about this if you want a little bit, but sometimes this last spring, I was falling back again, you know, and one of the things that he taught me was, you know, you just have to rebuke the devil. You just have to say, you know, Satan, I renounce you. I renounce feelings of despair. I renounce feelings of sadness. I renounce feelings of lost and isolation, everything, just you name it. You keep naming those things and you repeat that over and over. And I do that. And I do that from time to time. When I'm feeling good, you know, I don't say it as much, but if I start to see that the evil one is sort of creeping around again, I just pull that card out and I start to go through those renunciations and the lies. You know, you are loved, you know, you are, people do care about you, you know, you do have a purpose, you know, those kind of things. And renouncing the lies that Satan throws up to us, and then understanding that God is there, even though you can't sense or feel him. That's where I think people really do have to realize that the devil loves to take us to places that are very dark, especially when we're weak, either like, you know, lacking sleep or haven't been eating. Those are times when we're not healthy, that Satan rushes in and takes advantage of our weakness and sows seeds of doubt and all kinds of things. So the evil one, is powerless before Christ. And that's where we have to believe in and have the confidence that in Jesus' name, we can banish all these things, because the devil hates the name of Jesus. And if we invoke it over and over again, And he won't, you know, he's persistent, but you beat him back down, you know, over and over and over. Then eventually he vanishes.
Absolutely. And I've had the experience, the wonderful experience of actually doing the kinds of prayers that you're saying and going to conferences where deliverance was the main topic.
Mm-hmm.
Just the thought that there are, so you can have personal sins, there are generational sins. And so the things that are plaguing us and could be something that is generational. And so renouncing them in the name of Jesus breaks those generational sins, those generational ties, and releases you of things that hold you back or could affect your mental health, which is why I love that you had mentioned that penance and of course the Eucharist are so helpful, but penance is where you are forgiven for personal sins, et cetera, so that those things can't plague you in the same way that they do if that is part of the reason why there's mental health condition. And so obviously the sacraments are there for us, and the rosary, the liturgy of the hours, the psalms to help. I wanted to go back to a different point. You were talking about all the different experts that were part of your healing journey. You had the psychotherapist, you had the doctor, you had your spiritual director. Of course, you had the community of the family you were with, which all points to the fact that we are embodied human beings. And so tackling something like mental health is multifaceted, because you're dealing with the physical body. There might be physical signs, as you had, the symptoms, but there are the psychological, the spiritual. Could you talk a little bit more about the importance of addressing all those things? So from a physical perspective, the sleep, the healthy eating, the exercise, recreation, and then from the spiritual perspective, we talked about that. And then from, you know, relational component, which actually community helps us to, no man is an island. So community helps us to get back to being whole.
Right. Yeah. We're not alone. That's one of the things you hear a lot of that, you know, kind of, and it's interesting because mental health is such a big epidemic now. And as you mentioned, those statistics, I believe those statistics are true at the beginning of the podcast, you know, the worst thing we can do is to isolate ourselves. So, and to keep it all to ourselves. So reaching out, telling someone or asking someone or seeking help is so important, to know that there are people available and that it's not shameful, that it's not, it's just like somebody that, let's say they're suffering from diabetes. They're not going to be ashamed of, oh, now I got to take insulin, you know, and you're embarrassed about that. Well, maybe you're upset because you're, you know, physically you've got to depend upon something like insulin, but it's part of the human condition. And we, if we know and believe, and it's true, that there are people who are trained professionals in the mental health field that can help us and that are waiting for us to contact them. And oftentimes just reaching out to someone we can trust, you know, who then can maybe find help for us. And the worst is just to not tell anybody because you're ashamed of it, or because you're afraid what people might think, or you're afraid that you might be looked down upon, you know, as somebody who's damaged or who is, you know, not strong, because we have, you know, one of the things that was one of my biggest struggles, and I talk about this in the pastoral letter, is that, and I got this, I discovered this working with Dr. Bob Schutz with Healing the Whole Person. I went on a Healing the Whole Person retreat in August of 2021. So I had been back, not even a year. And I went on this retreat for bishops. And one of the things I learned through working with Dr. Schutz was that we were a kind of product of our culture. And in my particular situation, my father, who was my hero, he fought in World War II. He was a gunner on an aircraft carrier. And he came back from the war and, you know, fought in the Pacific Theater. When he came back, he met my mom, and shortly thereafter, he signed a baseball contract to play professional baseball with the Yankees and started out in their farm system. And he was a great athlete and all these things. And he instilled all that into me. And so he was my coach all during, you know, growing up. He was my, all through high school, he was my baseball coach, and I just looked up to him. But he instilled in me this idea that is very much part of our culture, especially for men. And that is this, what Bob Schuchz calls this ungodly self-reliance. Mm-hmm. You know, that we, if we are struggling, all we got to do is work harder. And if we are suffering, all we got to do is just white knuckle it, and then we'll get through anything. And you can be anything you want to be, and you can do anything you want to do, because his generation did that. I mean, they did remarkable things. I admire that ethic, that work ethic, and that kind of stick-to-itiveness that he instilled into me and my sister, that perseverance. Those are all good virtues. But bad side of that is that sometimes you can't, you know, sometimes you just can't fix it. You know, you can't, no matter how hard you work, you just can't do it. And to surrender, you know, and this is where this, another great prayer, the surrender prayer, became very important to me about this time, that God is the one really that heals us, and God is the one that directs us. And so what we have to do is surrender to him. And it's through our weakness and vulnerability that the power of God works in a beautiful way. And we're actually more powerful, and we're more together when we allow God in through our vulnerability and our weakness. And that, you know, one of the prayers that supposedly John the 23rd used to say during the Second Vatican Council, when it was chaos, he said at night, he said, "Lord, it's your church. I'm going to bed." and that is a beautiful thought, is that you, as a bishop, you're not going to fix all these problems. It's a messy church, you know, and you do what you can, you show up, you do your best, but then you surrender it all over. And so, Jesus, I surrender myself to you. You take care of it. And I actually just still say that over and over throughout the Jesus, I surrender myself to you. You take care of it. And there's a certain freedom in that, you know, that it's not up to me, you know, and who are you to think that you can fix everything? But that ungodly self-reliance is in our DNA, you know, especially men. And when they fail, you know, let's say they recognize their weakness, they feel like, you know, that they've failed everybody, their family, you know, their the people who love them. And that's not good thinking.
Yes. And we will actually link not only to the surrender prayer, but the beautiful surrender novena as well, which I think is super powerful. But I think that an unhealthy self-reliance is part of what's causing the mental health epidemic. I think that when people think that they have to do it all themselves, and especially for us, who have the faith, we know that Jesus did it for us, right? But we forget, and we think, oh, well, I have to take all of that on. No. Jesus has it. We are just cooperators. We are participants. We have to be willing participants, but let Jesus do the work. And I have to remind myself of that whenever I want to see a certain outcome, but really it's, no, let Jesus do the work. I'm just showing up, and he can do whatever he wants with this. And it's a daily reminder for myself, and hopefully someone who doesn't have faith can at least surrender to that they don't actually have to fix everything, even if it's not to a certain to God or to Jesus, but that you don't actually have to fix everything in your life. Just take the next step, show up, do the best you can, and take that pressure off, because I think that adds on to everyone's burden, the mental health burden, to be a certain way, to do a certain thing. Another question I have for you is about the medication part, because I think that in a lot of circles, even taking medication, there's a stigma surrounding that. You mentioned that you took medication and then you came off of the medication. Can you talk a little bit about your experience with that, and anyone who maybe has qualms about taking medication to help them, but at the same time, if they want to come off and they want to be free of medication, what are the steps to do that, and what your experience has been?
No, that's very good. I've thought about this a lot, because you know, these pharmaceuticals, especially antidepressants, can be very effective to get you forward to a place where your body then can kind of take over. And sometimes you need assistance. You know, you need assistance to get through a period of time that that you're not able to do about without the help of a medication. For example, sleeping. You know, sometimes you just can't make yourself go to sleep as much as you want to go to sleep. And so taking a sleeping medication, again, it's not the same as natural sleep, because I think natural sleep is really the ideal. But let's say you're so filled with thoughts and anxiety that you just cannot fall asleep. Well, there are medications that can help you fall asleep. And then by getting the rest that you need, your body then starts to heal itself, because you're not taxing it by exhaustion. You know, antidepressants, they are very interesting. In fact, one of the best books I've read is a book by Dr. Aaron Karate, I think his name is. And it's called The Catholic Guide to Depression. Cariotti, Aaron Cariotti. He's a psychiatrist and wonderful man. And a great book, Monsignor Sayak, who's a priest of Portland, wrote the introduction to it, who did his dissertation, you know, on some of these aspects, Monsignor John Sayak. But anyway, he goes through the whole list of the different kinds of pharmaceuticals, antidepressants, how they work in the body, you know, SSRIs and these kinds of medications. And the bad thing about medications are, and this is the frustrating thing, is that, you know, they take so long to take effect. So you've got to wait. Let's say you try a particular medication and it takes 4 to 6 weeks. And then, you know, let's say at the 4 or 5 week point, nothing's happening. Well, you've had 4 or 5 weeks of hell, you know, hoping that, you know, nothing's happening. And your psychiatrist says, well, okay, well, let's try this now. And it's a trial and error. And so that happened to me, you know, and I just, you know, I kind of was just giving up on these medications aren't helping at all. But finally, there was a combination, sort of a cocktail that my psychiatrist, in working with another psychiatrist, found that just helped me. And it got me to a point that sort of did two things. It stabilized my moods so that I wasn't just up one day and down the next, sort of a manic thing, but it was level. And it gave me some intellectual energy and emotional energy. So then I could, you know, I could get through some tasks and I could get through some things that I had to do. Even little things like getting up and going out and washing your car, you know, or something like that. It just seems so simple, but even when you're depressed, you don't want to do anything. You don't care. You don't care about doing your laundry. You don't care about eating, care about anything. So if you can get, you know, to this point where you can at least accomplish these very simple tasks, then the body sort of, yeah, I know I'm supposed to eat. Oh yeah, I know I'm supposed to get out. Oh yeah. And then your body kicks in, and then you can taper down often, but you have to titrate off, you know, as you go down, kind of wean yourself off of these medications, because the optimal thing is to be free of medications. But then some people really can't be free of medications their whole life. They need to be on something, and that's not bad. That's what it takes. That's what you need, and that's what you need. Like I mentioned to you before we went on camera, you know, I was going pretty good for about 5 years, and then last spring, I again kind of, it was like deja vu all over again. I went through this period of time, things mounted up. You know, I was again slipping back into these ideas that I got to fix this, you know, and this ungodly self-reliance. And I could see myself sort of going through, and I got back on. I hadn't been going to therapy for, you know, I touch base every now and then, but I finally got back to my therapist. I said, same thing's happening. I feel like it's all happening again. And he suggested, well, maybe you need to go on a low dose of medication. So I did. And he kind of talked me through some difficult things. And I remember to the day what happened. This was March 25th. Of this past spring, the Feast of the Annunciation. I just had to get out of the city. So I drove down to the Benedictine Sisters in Gower, Missouri, which I'm very close to, the one that do the Gregorian chant, the beautiful, yeah. Where St. Wilhelmina, not St., yeah. Sister Wilhelmina, she's probably saint, but you know, she's the incorrupt there. So I went down, and Mother Cecilia is a very good friend of mine. And so, and she has, a you know, 60 women, you know, in their community. And so there's bound to be psychological issues, right? And so we talk about that, you know, and talk about, I talk about my priest, she talks about her sisters. And so she's somebody I can trust. And I remember talking to her about this, and she was sharing some things with me. And I remember that that morning I reconsecrated myself to the Blessed Mother, because it was on the 25th of March in 1978 that I made my consecration according to St. Louis Marita Monfort. And again, that surrendering over to Mary was another layer of surrender. But also, which is really important, and I emphasize this more now than ever, especially with those who are struggling, I went for this long walk in the woods behind the monastery with my dog. And I came to a tree, and there was a ladder that was leaning up against the tree. And it was a cloudy day, but the clouds were breaking from time to time. And I just, that ladder was just sort of beckoning to me. I hadn't climbed a tree in decades. And so I climbed this tree. I climbed to the very top, and my dog was looking up like, have you lost your mind? Are you kidding me? And I climbed up to the top of this tree, and I just sat in this kind of fork in the tree. The wind was blowing. The tree was swaying a little bit. I was looking up, and I was seeing clouds go by, and every now and then the sun would come out. And there was something about that being rootedness in the ground, to see the sky above, the sun, everything was going to be okay. I wasn't going to slide back, because I had those same thoughts. I'm going to slide right back to where I was. I mean, this time I'm going to have to take a permanent leave of absence, you know. And I came down from the tree, and I came back, and I went back to Lincoln. And from that day forward, things got better. But I went back on medication, and I'm still on medication now, a very low dose of an antidepressant and duloxetine, and sometimes called Cymbalta, and then gabapentin, which is sort of a, it kind of gives you a little bit of energy, but it's very mild dose. And so I was just talking to my nurse practitioner, who's also a psychotherapist, and he was saying, if you have no side effects, then why go off of it? So I'm still on it, and maybe I will go off of it. And also I'm taking some mirtazapine, which helps me sleep. I've never slept better. But, you know, eventually maybe I would, but as long as I'm not experiencing any side effects and I can think clearly and I'm not, my energy level is really good, I don't see a reason to go off the medication.
And I think that's helpful for people to hear, that it's not just it might be that you don't need medication, or it might be that you need to stay, as you mentioned. And so people shouldn't have shame about what their needs are. And if they need it, they need it. And if they feel like it's superfluous to their own health at that point, they come off of it. And I think there's a freedom there, again, because there's so much stigma surrounding that. Regarding the stigma, have you encountered, because of your openness about this issue, what kind of reactions have you encountered, both positive? You mentioned the positive ones about your diocesan lay people, just really understanding where you're coming from. But have you had any negative feedback about your openness?
I've had some. I think, you know, maybe people who are kind of on eggshells around me, thinking, you know, I don't want to say the wrong thing. You know, it's more of an awkwardness, I think, on their part than on my part. But I sense that sometimes in people. Or, you know, I think people, and I don't mind this, but people who maybe don't come to me or ask me to do things, thinking that maybe that's going to place too much of a burden, and that I, you know, I'm still fragile. And so they're kind of, that's out of respect. For the most part, I really haven't, you know, I haven't really sensed any negativity in the sense that, well, you know, he's gone through this, so he's really not fully competent in what he's doing as bishop, you know. But heck, I'm in the fourth quarter, you know, I can almost see the goal line from here. So in a way, in one sense, I don't care. You know, I'm not looking for anything. In other words, I'm not looking for any promotion. I'm happy where I am. You know, I don't want more responsibility. I don't want to be, you know, I don't want to move from my diocese. I wouldn't want to go to a larger, more, you know, difficult situation. I'm happy where I am. So that, in that sense, doesn't bother me that maybe, you know, my career, so to speak, is sort of reached its plateau. Fine.
Thank you for sharing that. I have a few questions left. I know that we're really deep into it, and so it's gold. It's pure gold. You also spoke about St. Francis de Sales' simple practicing of acknowledging, offering, and accepting that has helped you. Can you walk us through how you to apply that in the typical day when you have a mental health struggle?
I think it's the reminding that's, like I say, I keep that surrender prayer sort of under my breath throughout the day, and just kind of say it to myself, Jesus, I surrender myself to you. You take care of it. You know, kind of just really living that and not, I can feel myself sometimes when, let's say we're going through a big strategic plan in the diocese, a 5-year plan, and we had these listening sessions, you know, throughout the diocese. And we now at the point where we had a 2-day session where with about 16 people to look and, you know, see what our overall objectives are, our priorities, and then SMART goals and everything that falls under that. I had to resist, you know, trying to imposing my will on the whole process and like, you know, this is what I'd like to see done. This is what I want to, instead of just doing what I should do. And that is surrender to what the Holy Spirit wants and let the Holy Spirit. So I suppose I remember one time Archbishop Chaput, who was my archbishop when I was first named a bishop in Denver. And he used to say, you know, my job as a bishop is to get out of the way of the Holy Spirit. And that's the hardest thing to do, is to get out of the way, you know, to let the Holy Spirit. And to allow the Holy Spirit to act in the group too. You know, one of the things I tell my own closest collaborators, the worst thing you can say is whatever you want, Bishop, you know, and that's not helpful. And it's partly because they respect the office of bishop and, you know, they want me to lead. I get that. It's not about what I want. It's what God wants. And we need to discern together what's best for the diocese, what's best for the church, and to surrender that and to try to help discern. It's a discernment of spirits. What is best for the church in this situation or the diocese in this situation? So that's kind of an area that I still kind of struggle in. But I'm learning. I'm still learning.
Thank you for sharing that. Again, it's a daily task, even moment by moment, to say, I'll surrender this moment because certain things are always out of your control. And it's just really just handing it over and being okay with letting God take over and trusting that doing that means it's in the best place possible because he will do with it much greater things than we can do on our own. Right.
Right. His solutions and his what he has in mind for us is much better than we can possibly come up with.
I want to switch over to a topic near and dear to my heart, which are pets and the impact that your Stella had on your journey to healing and what the gift of pets means for emotional and mental health and what it means for you.
Well, you know, I think that my thinking has kind of evolved, you know, over the years. I had pets when I was growing up. And then when I got to be an adult, I couldn't have any pets because I was always either in the seminary or, you know, in Rome, et cetera. But I always wanted to have a dog again when I could, you know, have the place where I could take care of a dog. So it was actually during COVID that Bishop Wall, my good friend in Gallup, he heard about, through his housekeeper daughter, had golden retriever that had 12 puppies. And he's a big dog guy. He loves golden retrievers. And he's got 2 right now, and he's always had a couple dogs. He said, maybe I'll get a dog. He says, it's great. And he had been talking to me about that. I said, okay, maybe I was desperate, you know, anything that might help. And so, and I knew that, you know, I knew that, for example, service dogs are real, you know, people, especially young children, you know, it does a world of good. And my sister raises horses. And I know that she has a great love for horses, and just being around an animal like a horse is just something soothing about it, something that's very comforting. And so we went to El Paso, Texas, back in April of 2020, right in the midst of COVID, and picked up 4 puppy golden retrievers, one for me, one for him, one for the retreat director where I was staying, and one for his housekeeper. And that's where Stella came. And she's been with me ever since. She's right here. And there's just something about, especially for a celibate who lives by himself, a priest or a bishop, to know, you know, there's somebody at home when you come home who's happy to see you, you know, always happy to see you. And somebody, some other creature that you can interact with, you know, that's a sentient creature that, you know, will respond to you, that also will respond to emotionally to you and your needs. It's just been a great consolation. You know, it's again, like you were saying, it's a combination of things. Having this dog, Stella, has been one of the things that has really helped me, I think, in my own mental health. Yeah, I've become a big dog guy.
Yeah, so we've been dog people for a while, and I'm not sure we can say the same thing about cats. They're not always happy to see you, but dogs always are. But I don't want to start a whole debate about dogs and cats.
We've been in trouble.
Yes, our dog passed away a few months ago, and we actually just adopted a new dog because we think it's good for the family. It's good for our son to be around pets. And so we're in the same boat. We think that animals are a good addition. And actually we went, because it is the Feast of St. Francis, we went for a pet blessing. And so it was just beautiful to see. This is another expression, God's expression of love towards us by giving us creatures that are so lovable.
Right. You know, I think it's all part of this sacramental imagination because, I'm going to be, there's a few dogs that are coming over to my house later on this afternoon to have a blessing on St. Francis feast day. But, you know, to see that God has given us these creatures as part of his sign of love for us. If we believe that a sacrament is an outward sign instituted by Christ to give grace, which with a big S, the seven sacraments do that in a very efficacious way. But also there are many sacraments with a small s, you know, God's creation, like animals, trees, grass. And all of these, because God created them in goodness, that they are also, and you got to be careful about this, but little sacraments, because they point to his goodness. And God gave us these things to help us get through this veil of tears, you know, and I think pets are one of these things. And I think that children that grow up with pets like Kieran, you know, will have also a contact with real things are so important for children. I mean, children have been kind of removed from reality and live in a sort of virtual world. And, you know, the book I've been really promoting is the Anxious Generation by Jonathan Haidt, who talks about the impact of technology on mental health and the rise of the epidemic of mental health issues with young people because they're in front of screens all the time. And the best way to the antidote to that is to get away from the screen, get outside with an animal, climb a tree, you know, go for a walk. You know, those are all kind of antidotes to this highly technologized world in which we live.
Amen. Amen to that. And taking a walk, getting some fresh air, getting vitamin D, sunlight, climbing trees. We're teaching our son to climb trees. All help in grounding us, as you said. And so thank you for saying that. We're coming up on the last two or three questions here. I want to ask you about, you speak of the Catholic view of mental health, which is grounded in reason and revelation. Could you elaborate on what makes Catholic vision of mental health distinct?
Well, I think the most important thing is a proper anthropology, that, you know, we have to have a vision of the human person made in the image and likeness of God, with an inherent dignity and sanctity that is who we are. So a healthcare professional that doesn't share this vision of the human person, maybe they look at the human person more as an organism that needs to be manipulated or treated in such a way for it to live. There is that part of it, but to see beyond that to the person, I think is very important that we choose healthcare professionals who have the same vision of the human person that we do. And that there's a reverence for the body, for example, John Paul II's theology of the body. And, you know, that to see that we're created good in God's image, and that our human sexuality, there's a sacredness about it. It's to be respected, not to be altered. You know, like this whole transgender lie that, you know, somehow God creates some people in the wrong bodies, you know, which is not true. You know, God created everyone just the way. Now, we're not perfect, but he created us male and female. And that's good. And we should be in touch with our maleness and our femininity and praise that and say, this is the way I'm made, and not want to try to surgically manipulate it into something that it's not, because I think that only leads to frustration. So it's really important, I think, that those people we seek don't necessarily have to be Catholic, but they have to have this proper anthropology where they know that what they're looking at, the patient they're looking at in front of them, is someone who's mysterious, you know, who has a soul, an immortal soul, and that, you know, you treat them with this respect is sort of reverential, and putting Christ back in the center of healthcare.
Beautiful. And we will definitely be taking on the topic of, you know, hormonal and surgical interventions on people with gender dysphoria, especially children. So that will come up in other episodes. In talking about seeking wholeness and holiness, and you said that the well-being we were made for is nothing less than the goodness found in Jesus Christ. Can you be holy even if you struggle with mental health? And what saints struggled with mental health? Let's give some hope to people.
Yes. No, I mean, you know, some would say the saints were all crazy. You know, and they were. I mean, Francis, we celebrate St. Francis today. His dad thought he was stark raving mad. And some of the things that Francis did were crazy, you know. But I think that the saints show us a side of humanity which is madly in love with God, and that even those saints that did suffer from, and I know they were, maybe they weren't diagnosed with mental health issues, but they probably did have mental health issues, you know, whether it be depression. You know, I think some of the, I mean, like we talk about, I mean, I think St. John of the Cross couldn't really have written about the dark night of the soul unless he himself experienced depression. He knew what it was like to be absolutely isolated and, you know, be abandoned. You know, those kinds of experiences that the saints have gone through. But to be comfortable with the fact that God is calling each one of us to be holy, and it doesn't depend on our own ability or disability. God is the one who makes saints. God is the one who makes us holy and sanctifies us, and he sanctifies us in and through our own deficiencies. So whether, let's say we're, you know, we're manic depressive, or we are bipolar. It's not what this thing, you call it now, bipolar. God will use that, you know, to make you holy. And let's say you suffer from anxiety. You know, you have episodes of anxiety, or you have a paranoia, or you're fearful. You know, that God will kind of rush into those aspects of your being that are vulnerable, and he will give you grace even in that vulnerable state, so that holiness doesn't depend on, you know, is holiness and healthiness. I think that you know, even in struggling with our health and well-being, and let's say we're somewhat deficient in our health and well-being, that holiness, that doesn't prevent grace from coming in and healing us. You know, may not fix whatever it is we're struggling, but it's a source of grace and strength to be able to embrace it and to live with it with joy. And I think of, like, for instance, those who have disabilities. I mean, gosh, you know, the Down syndrome kids, they're the happiest people on earth.
Yes.
You know, and they're holy. Yeah. And, you know, and some would say, you know, they're not productive, or they're not, you know, contributing to the common good because they have these disabilities. But I think it's exact. We're the ones with the disabilities if we can't see them.
Exactly. And we're too fixated on production instead of the dignity of the person. And that's another topic we will cover in a different episode as well. So if you yourself, or if you know of someone, in whether it's a family or friend, struggling with mental health, what's the best way that you can be supportive?
Well, I think that to reach out, if you yourself are suffering, to reach out and to find someone trusted, you trust, that you can be open with and that you can share your struggles with. And that may only be one person that you really do. But don't keep it to yourself, to reach out. And if you know of someone that's struggling, you know, sometimes people are turned off by this, but, you know, if you kind of sense someone struggling, to say something in a very kind of loving and non-threatening ways, how are you doing? You seem like you're down a little bit, or seems like you're struggling with something. Is there anything I can do? You know, without like, and you know, your reaction is going to be, no, I'm okay. I'm fine. Don't worry. I'm good. But then, you know, if it persists, just keep asking them, you know, and then finally, you know, they'll say something like, you keep asking me about, and you know, honestly, I'm not doing well. And you've been bugging me about this and I need to talk to somebody, you know? And if you do it in a loving way, I think eventually it'll motivate them to want to get help.
Wonderful. And the very last question is, if someone is suffering right now in deep darkness, what is the first message of hope you would offer them?
This too shall pass. This too shall pass. You know, that it might seem like you're at the end of the rope and there's no future, but there's always a future with hope. There's always hope. Just stay the course, show up.
And that's exactly the message of your pastoral letter, hope. And thank you so much, Bishop Conley, for sharing your story, but also being vulnerable with us, because I think it gives permission for other people to be vulnerable. And I believe that our listeners are really going to take a lot out of our episode, and hopefully it helps them in their journey. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Arena.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the Bioethics Babe podcast. If you've enjoyed this content, please subscribe to my YouTube channel and your favorite podcast platform, and share with your friends and family. Also check out bioethicsbabe.com for the latest episodes and resources.